Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Dr. Kate Bieberdorf wants you to know that chemistry is not confined to a lab. It's all around us every day. The Associate Professor of Chemistry at the University of Texas at Austin demonstrates that in her lectures in her introductory chemistry class in front of 500 undergraduates, in thousands of demonstrations for school-aged children, and in her children's books. After hearing all sorts of questions from children and students, she noticed parents and teachers were also asking fundamental questions about chemistry's influence on our daily life. So her latest book is for the rest of us, the adults, in It's Elemental, The Hidden Chemistry in Everything, which combines an entertainingly written primer on elemental chemistry, filled with pop culture references to explain the concepts, and an imaginary day demonstrating how chemistry interacts with our every activity, from how the caffeine we consume first thing in the morning works, to how our workouts burn energy, to how soaps and shampoos work, the compositions of our clothes and makeup, the chemistry in the kitchen, and to how alcohol affects us at happy hour, or at the end of the day with our partners, or in sleep. Kate Bieberdorf has a PhD in inorganic chemistry from the University of Texas at Austin, where she teaches, and works to bring more women into the STEM fields, and is the author of the Kate the Chemist series, the Big Book of Experiments, and the awesome book of Edible Experiments for Children. And her latest book is titled It's Elemental. Kate Bieberdorf, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, I know you've been writing a lot of books for especially girls, but also, you know, young people about science and about chemistry. And you've done a whole series of books. Now, this new book, It's Elemental, seems to be for the rest of us. Why did you decide to write It's Elemental?
It is. You're right. This is my first book for adults. I'm very excited to release this. But I've been doing, like you said, the kind of shows for kids. I've been trying to get kids excited about science for years. And so I've been blowing stuff up for them, doing anywhere between 2 to 9 shows a week, often at elementary schools. But what I found is that once I'm done with all these explosions, afterwards, the parents and teachers come up and they're like, oh, this little kindergartner has a question about sunscreen or nuclear warfare. And I'm like, really? This five-year-old does, or does this teacher, or does mommy have this question? And so over time, I started putting all their questions together in this big list. And essentially, that's what this book ended up being. And so I take you all through a very, very busy day. And I try to explain my favorite parts of chemistry that we experience on an everyday basis. One of the things I joke about all the time is that whether you like it or not, when you're in the kitchen making dinner, breakfast, a pie, you're being a chemist. You are moving molecules around. You're making bonds, breaking bonds. You're changing molecular interactions. And so it's literally around us all day, every day.
Well, the first half of the book is basically, I think, a high school chemistry class boiled down to about 4 chapters. And people saying, oh my God, I don't want to go near this. It is actually quite breezily written, and you make it fun. You explain attractions in terms of Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah, I do.
What are the important things we need to know before we actually tackle how chemistry affects everything from what we eat, how we clean, how we have fun, how we make things in the kitchen, how we dress, how we, you know, everything that the book tackles?
Well, it's so interesting because I've been teaching at the University of Texas for years. So I have 500 students in my classroom, and I have 2 of those, so I have 1,000 students per semester. And so I've been testing out these analogies on these students for years. And it's like, okay, you seem to not be understanding how the atom looks, so let me describe it using a human body. Or maybe you don't understand how a double replacement reaction works, so let me tell you the story about how Blake Lively and Ryan Reynolds met, because their first date was exactly the same as a double replacement reaction. And so I know it's goofy, I know it's a little silly, but honestly, nobody wants to read a chemistry textbook. Like, I know that, I understand that, I like it, I power through one of those, but not everybody wants to read that. And so what I did in this first part, and it's not the first half, it's just the first part, it's a very short section, it's essentially just like Chem 101. And so it's, what's an atom? What's a molecule? What's a physical change? What's a chemical change? Those are the big 4 ideas. And then after just a couple pages, we knock that out, and then I jump into the meat and potatoes of the book, which is really just like you said, we go through a very, very busy day, starting with breakfast and the early morning workout. We go to the beach, we make a pie, we get ready, even the science of date night. And so I just try to bring all of my favorite examples alive. And like you said, I use some goofy analogies along the way.
Yeah. Breakfast and food is the first section. And the first thing you jump into is caffeine. Almost everybody uses caffeine to get started in the morning. For some, it's diet soda. For most, it's coffee to sort of open our eyes and get us started. And that whole idea of caffeine, there are scientists that have spent a lot of time figuring out how the best way to get caffeine into us and make it efficient and make it taste good at the same time, because caffeine apparently tastes very, very bad.
Yeah, very bitter. It's very bitter. It's an odorless white powder. The molecule is named trimethylxanthine. And if you were to just eat it, it would be disgusting. You wouldn't like that at all. But caffeine is really cool because it acts like a psychoactive drug. So the same way a nicotine or morphine works in our body, caffeine messes with the way our brain functions or behaves. And so what it does is it goes in and it binds with these receptors in your brain that are meant to bind with a completely different molecule. So that molecule's name is adenosine, and adenosine is used to produce RNA, which is essential for human life. But more importantly, on this topic, adenosine makes us feel sleepy or drowsy. So when this molecule binds to your brain, all of a sudden our bodies get sleepy and drowsy. And so what caffeine does is it comes in and is like, nope, 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 and it bounces adenosine right out of your brain, and so it blocks that one from binding to your receptors. So your caffeine's just like a bouncer. It doesn't actually give you energy. It just blocks another molecule from making you feel sleepy or drowsy.
And you go into the whole idea of how different coffees process caffeine and how it processes caffeine into us. Can you give us some ideas about how coffee does that?
Well, sure. And it's just about the process of how you're actually extracting the caffeine. Are you exposing it or not? And so if you use really big coffee grounds, things that are open or like big beans, if you will, you're not going to have as much surface area. So it's going to be harder for you to actually get that caffeine into your water, which is then when you drink it. So we need to kind of move it through the process to help us drink it, obviously. Because you're not, well, at least I'm not chomping on coffee beans when I drink a coffee. And I'm actually a Diet Coke girl. I don't really drink much coffee, but my husband does. And so I've watched him use a number of different processes. But essentially, it's very simple. What you want to do is take your coffee grounds and grind them up a little bit. Like, you don't want these full beans. You want to expose the surface area. And anytime you expose surface area, what you're doing is allowing for the water to form a molecular interaction with your coffee bean or your coffee grounds. And so the more coffee grounds that are exposed, the easier it is for the water to make these bonds. And so in general, the more you grind something up, the more likely it is that you'll be able to get your caffeine. But then there's a whole other process of how you prepare it. If you want to use pressure, that's more like your espressos, and that gets a lot of caffeine, which is why we use those in really small serving cups. You would not want a giant cup of an espresso, because that wouldn't be good, because you'd have way too much caffeine. And you can actually overdose from coffee or from caffeine. I don't know if people know this. It would take a lot, though. So since I'm Diet Coke, my example is always, it's over 200 cans of Diet Coke I'd have to drink pretty much in one setting in one day to overdose, or 50 cups of coffee, which is just a lot. So it's really hard to do that, but you can if you really try. Yeah.
Now, we always think of espresso as having more caffeine. It sounds like it's more efficient at extracting caffeine into.
Exactly.
So why does pressure do that?
Well, it's the way we prepare it, right? So if you push something down, right, if you're pushing it down, you're going to crack the beans, essentially, and you're going to expose the, just like we were talking about before. So it's always about surface area. Can you get your solvent or your water to actually grab that coffee bean and form that molecular interaction? And so when pressure, it's something that my college freshmen have a really hard time understanding or visualizing. But pressure is essentially force per unit area. And so how much can you push on how small of an area? And the smaller your coffee bean, and then the more you push, the more you can actually, this is a major oversimplification, but you can essentially push the caffeine out of the coffee bean and allow for the water to form that interaction.
From caffeine, you talk about preparing foods. I found it interesting, like you were talking about eggs and the fact that a fried egg looks one way, scrambled eggs looks a different way, and that is simply temperature. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah, exactly. And so it has to do with which type of egg you're exposing or which protein piece you're exposing, and the inside, so your yolk is going to be heated to a certain temperature. So for example here, your egg whites, let's start with the egg whites actually, because that's probably easier. Your egg whites start to solidify at about 63 degrees Celsius. And so for those of you who aren't in Celsius, and that's not how you think, like that would be about 145 degrees Fahrenheit, where the yolks themselves, they actually take a lot more heat, and that's just because they're more concentrated. They have more proteins. It takes longer for them to denature, to open up, and then to actually go through that change. And so that's a little bit hotter, maybe 7-ish degrees warmer. So those change phase around 70 degrees Celsius. But what's really cool is if you mix your entire egg together, which you should do with a whisk, by the way, I'll come back to that in just a second. But when you mix your eggs together, you can actually increase its resistance. You provide stability to the eggs itself. All those interactions, it's an increase in entropy, and I won't take you down the thermodynamics route. But because of that, what happens is it really provides stability for the egg, and so it can get a little bit warmer. And so when you mix your whites and your yolks together, it can get up to 73 degrees, which I know doesn't sound like a huge change from the 70 degrees of the yolk, but it is, and we can actually heat it a little bit more, and that actually will affect the taste of it. And I know I mentioned the whisk. I highly recommend for everybody to use a whisk to prepare your eggs instead of a fork. If you picture a fork, it has those really stabby ends on them, so it's going to actually go in. And if you're not careful, you can break the molecular bonds in the molecule and kind of rip them up a little bit. And so it's quite a harsh tool to use on your molecules for your eggs. So I strongly encourage everyone to use a whisk, and I'm sure you can all picture a whisk, so it has that round, curvy end. And when you use that, it's much gentler on the eggs themselves. And so instead of breaking bonds and kind of damaging the proteins, it allows for them to mix together carefully without kind of messing any of the molecular integrity.
And so that's from the chemistry basis, but from the food intake basis, what does the scrambled eggs look like? I mean, what's the difference in the actual end product with a fork versus the whisk?
Well, you probably aren't going to see a difference. I mean, this is macro versus micro, to be perfectly honest. You got me on that one. You're not going to see a difference for that. But you might taste a difference, maybe. But we definitely can show that when you use sharp tools like that, it does rip apart the protein. So you'd have to be really aggressive and go after your eggs, like stabbing them quite a lot with a fork to make a huge difference where you probably would taste it. But from a molecular level, we really do encourage you to use a whisk just because it's nicer. You can form intermolecular forces with the whisk and with the water that's actually sitting in your eggs that holds those proteins. So it's just a gentler process.
And I've always heard that, like, the more vigorously you whisk your eggs, you're putting more air into the, I guess, the solution, if you will. And so when you prepare your eggs, they'll be more fluffier.
Yep, makes tons of sense, right? Because as you whisk, you're coming out of the solution, and then you put the whisk right back in. And so as you push the whisk in on the molecular level, there's going to be air molecules sitting on top of your solution all over the place. And so as you push your whisk into the egg solution, we'll just call it the liquid. So as you push that in, you're actually pushing the air molecules into that egg solution, that liquid. And so it's essentially aerating your egg. So if you blew bubbles, it's a similar process. It's just very strange to blow bubbles in your egg mixture.
Well, from that breakfast, you go to working out. And I just heard an article, says, you know, it was on the internet, so we have to take it for what it's worth, but it did catch my eye. It said, working out doesn't change metabolism. And I go, well, that's really interesting. But I read a little bit of your chapter, and I now learned that exercise is not changing your metabolism. It's just making your body more efficient at processing energy. And when you're working out, while in the active phase of working out, your body can't process its energy that's stored, and it turns to burning fat.
Yeah.
It's really during the workout time is when you're actually working on fat reserves.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because your body, when it burns fat, right, it gets a certain amount of calories, if you will, and we can talk a bit about that. So when you're looking at a container, like a nutrition label, we report things in a calorie with a capital C. So that's a nutritional unit. And so that is actually one calorie with a capital C is equal to 1,000 calories lowercase c, which is a scientific unit. And I know that doesn't sound like a big difference, but it really is in our world. So for example, if you eat like eight peanut butter pretzels, those are my favorite, you can get 140 nutritional calories or 140,000 scientific calories. And so what happens is this food goes into your body, and your body starts to digest the food. So we use these enzymes that are in our stomach and our intestine to actually attack the food and then break it down. And what are we doing when we break it down? Well, we're essentially trying to form glucose, so sugar. And so the second step is going through glycolysis. And so glycolysis is breaking down the glucose, like just what it sounds like. And so when we do this, we break down the glucose that's formed during your digestion into smaller units called pyruvates. And so these pyruvates then are super important because that's what does like the very next step, which allows us to do step three, which is the most important. And so essentially, they break themselves down, they form carbon dioxide. So when you're exhaling, you're always exhaling your carbon dioxide, but you're actually exhaling your fat. That's how you get lose weight. It comes out through your lungs. Nobody believes that. It's all through the water vapor as well. But through this process, you essentially form some acetyl function groups, and those are able to form oxaloacetate. And that is one of the most important things because these molecules then enter your citric acid cycle. And through a lot of chemistry, and I realize I'm diving too deep in this now, so let me pull back. But they enter the citric acid cycle, and eventually they make this amazing molecule called adenosine triphosphate, or ATP. And that is the entire point of eating. It gives us energy, and it's our molecular unit of currency. So now ATP is actually what allows us to move. So it releases energy in order for us to do an action. So it's stored all over our bodies. And so imagine just one cell in your body. There's 1 billion molecules of ATP in that cell. And then 2 minutes go by, and this amazing chemistry happens, and ATP is either converted into ADP or AMP, but then it's converted back to ATP. So essentially, you have 1 billion molecules of ATP in a cell in your body. After 2 minutes go by, it's converted into ADP and then back into ATP. And this process goes on forever until eventually the cell dies for a number of reasons, like you get an injury or, you know, who knows what.
Mm-hmm.
So cool.
I want to go back to what you were saying about how fat is exhaled. I think people, that would blow people's minds. It blew my mind. I didn't realize that's how we release fat is while we're exercising. During the actual process of exercise, as we're breathing in, oxygen. We're also breathing out a little bit of carbon dioxide. And I learned earlier in the book, it's not all carbon dioxide. Most of what we breathe out is inert gases, just like what we breathed in was inert gases. But we're also, when we're exercising, we're breathing out fat.
Yes. And you're doing it through carbon dioxide. So to be very clear, what happens is you take this fat, essentially, you go through that entire process I just talked through, and you form ATP. And when you take ATP and you then want to use it, like let's say you want to run for a bus or you want to kick a soccer ball, what we do is we burn it. And so just like we've seen us, like any fire, if you've seen that, it's the same thing, but just on the molecular level, and we burn ATP. And so that's a combustion reaction, and that's an exothermic reaction. It releases heat. That's why we get hot when we work out, because our body is literally going through little fires inside and releasing carbon dioxide and water vapor. And so these two things, the carbon dioxide and water vapor, are released during every combustion reaction. So when you burn your ATP, that's how you release these two pieces. So then, if you think about what happens when you're working out, your body gets hot, and what do you do with your breath? You're, right? You're breathing right. Constantly because you've got all of this air that's now being formed, if you will, and I'm kind of simplifying that, and you're pushing it out through your lungs, either in the form of carbon dioxide gas or water vapor. So it's so cool because, like, many people think they're, like, losing the weight. They burn it, and then they, like, go to the bathroom and lose it that way, or they, like, wash it off themselves in the shower or something. But, no, it's all in your lungs. You've got this carbon dioxide in the water, and it's just coming out, and the human body is just so amazing. It's full of chemistry. So every time you breathe, every time you run, every time you brush your hair, you're using chemistry.
Yeah, and getting back to that article, I think there's also a notion that if you are exercising actively, it will affect your metabolism throughout the rest of the day. Is there any truth to that?
There is. Yeah, there absolutely is. And so what it does is it encourages your body to continue burning these high levels of fatty acids after the workout session. And so what we found is that if you're a runner, you burn a lot of fatty acids during your workout session. But then afterwards, not so much. But if you take HIIT classes, so those high-intensity interval training classes, which I've got to admit I'm partial to, they show that you continue to do this. Like, you've gotten your heart rate up so much during that workout that your body is still burning ATP. It's like it's recovering. And so it's trying to go back through and fix all of your damaged cells. And doing that, it burns your ATP, and you continue to lose weight. So that's the current theory, if you will. I subscribe to it, but that's because I'm very biased. I don't like running. I like the high-intensity interval classes. I used to be a fitness trainer for Nike, and so I would do these HIIT classes essentially. And so that's my preferred workout. That being said, we all know running and biking are great workouts. They're good for your heart. They help with your cholesterol levels. So I'm not going to knock any of it. In general, you get an equivalent workout. It's just that the HIIT classes, you burn it longer after you've worked out, whereas with running, you burn it more during the workout. But they're both really good, and you should just do what you like because you're more willing to do that more frequently, and that's all that matters.
You go through the chemistry that's involved with the things we put on our face, our cleaning products, our personal body cleaning products, as well as the cleaning products in the kitchen. Is there anything we need to keep in mind about things to avoid in those particular areas?
Well, it depends. I've mentioned a couple. I do call out a couple molecules by name with shampoo. We can talk about that one because Everybody uses shampoo. And so in general, shampoo is essentially a liquid, usually a liquid, that contains surfactants. And surfactants are really neat molecules. They have two sides. So one side is hydrophobic. It doesn't like water. And one side is hydrophilic. It does like water. And so because of this, the side that doesn't like water actually likes the oil and grease in your hair. And so it grabs onto that. It like clings onto it with a death grip. And then as soon as you jump back into the water stream, so the shower water is coming back down over your head, the side of the surfactant that likes water is like, ooh, I would much prefer the water over the grease in your hair. So it reaches out and grabs the water. So one end of the molecules grab to the water, the other end of the molecules grab to the grease in your hair, and essentially the grease and oil is pulled out of your hair and down with gravity down the shower drain. So that's how a surfactant works. And you'll see surfactants all over the place. You see them in your dish soaps, you see them anytime you're cleaning, pretty much anything. So now, in general, with shampoo, there's three molecules that I tend to avoid, some more than others. So, for example, parabens. Parabens are great because they combat bacteria. However, there was a really small study that said that in women that had breast cancer, they were able to track some parabens in those tumors. It was one study, one time, and it had a really small N value. It was something like 24 women, so it wasn't very high, and that's all we've had to study to back that up since then. So is it enough to say that parabens cause cancer? No, it's not. But do I avoid parabens? Yes. That was enough for me to just stay away from them because there's like, what's the point, right? Like, we can combat bacteria other ways. So silicone is another one, and this is more just for the appearance of what happened. So silicone's a great molecule for shampoo because it helps to minimize friction between strands. So it kind of coats the ends of your hair strands, and then it allows for it to glide past each other. The problem is silicone's a great molecule. A bigger version of it is caulk, right? So it's a really good molecule and it actually holds very well. We've experienced that before. So on the smaller scale, what happens is you end up getting like a buildup. So if you've ever seen somebody that their hair just looks greasy, but you know they just showered, it's probably because they have too much silicone in their shampoo. And you see that a lot with those cheaper shampoos, those ones that are really inexpensive. And so that's one thing you'd want to avoid. Mm. And then sulfates is the last one. So those are the big three. You've got your parabens, your silicone, and your sulfates. And the sulfates essentially just remove too much grease. So this is the one your hairstylists hate, especially if you have curly hair. And they're like, stay away from sulfates because it's really good at removing the grease. But the problem is it dries out your hair. So if you have curly hair especially, you definitely want to avoid sulfates because your hair is usually already pretty dry. So that's something you want to avoid. I'm going to be honest with you. I really like bubbles. So I have a hard time avoiding certain surfactants in my shampoo. Like, I know there's ones that you can have, like, no suds, and I just can't handle that. I'm a girl who likes some bubbles in my shampoo. So I have surfactants, but I do tend to avoid parabens. Like, that's the one I would try to avoid if I were you.
My guest today is Kate Bieberdorf. She's an associate professor of chemistry at the University of Texas at Austin, and her latest book is titled It's Elemental, The Hidden Chemistry in Everything. There's a great section on baking. You're a baker, and you talk about the chemistry that's involved in baking. But I want to jump ahead to happy hour because there is a long discussion of alcohol, everything from how wine is made, how alcohol affects us, how they make alcohol, the various alcohols. This must have been a fun chapter to write.
Oh, you're telling me. I had such a blast. I'll be honest, I had so much fun writing this one. I enjoy a cocktail every once in a while. But in the chapter, you're right. I talk about how the process of making wine and beer and sake, it's very similar. They have a general overall process. It's extraordinarily complex, especially if you go on any type of tour and you go through and you talk to the experts. They all have very specific things they do to make their wine taste exactly like this. But in general, the process is quite simple. The first thing you have to do is extract the sugar. So if you're talking about a wine, your sugar is going to come from your grapes. And so you've got to get the sugar from the grapes first. If you're talking about a beer, that usually comes from a starch. A classic example would be barley. And so once you have your sugar, then you can do the fun part, the second part, that's fermentation. And this is where you add your yeast. And so your yeast reacts with your sugar, and it forms two molecules. Carbon dioxide, which we already talked about, but we don't care about in this chapter. In this chapter, we care about the other one. And so that's alcohol or ethanol specifically. So for those of you who drink alcohol to get that lovely, nice, mood-elevating feeling, ethanol is the reason why. That's the molecule. So it goes all the way through fermentation. The yeast and the sugar react, and they form this ethanol. And then once you have the ethanol, a lot of different things can be done to just perfect the taste and get it exactly how you want it to taste. But the last step is usually some form of filtration. So there's a lot of byproducts in here. You have a lot of, like, maybe you've got the grape skins, or you've got different pieces of the, you know, just whatever you put in there, and you want to filter it out. And so the very last step is filtration. And then once you've done that, you store your species for wine. It's super important that you get corked wines that are laid on the side. You don't ever want to buy wine that's standing straight up. So the reason being is those corks have nice wide gaps in there. And so when you put the wine on the side, you're able to actually use the water or the liquid from the wine to get on the cork. That actually gets the cork wet, and that blocks. It's a physical blocker from letting any oxygen from the outside get into your wine. And so if you stand your wine up, then the cork can get dry because it's not interacting with the liquid anymore, and then the oxygen can easily jump through. So make sure you always store your wine on the side. There's a reason why we ask you to do that. For beer, the big thing is that you want to store it in a cold, dark place. So the aromatic molecules in beer are very light sensitive, and so usually beers in lighter bottles or cans don't do as well. So the darker beers are good for a reason. Like, there's a reason they're amber bottles, and it's just to protect those aromatic, lovely flavors in your beer.
And you also explain how alcohol affects us and how it interacts with, say, our sodium and calcium levels and potassium levels, mm-hmm. and then also how it deals with our brain chemistry and our neurotransmitters. How does ethanol interact with us to give us the feeling, especially when we've had it one too many?
Right. So ethanol interacts with your brain, and essentially your brain then releases dopamine. That's the very first thing it does. And we all know that dopamine is that happy molecule. It makes us feel happy. It gives us that mood elevation. But on a more technical level, the ethanol actually interacts with our sodium, potassium, and calcium channels, just like you said. When that happens, that messes with our neurotransmitter in our brains, one very specifically, GABA. Now, this one inhabits our brain activity. And so this is why we can actually watch the direct effects of this on a drunk person. So like clumsiness or slurred speech, anything like that, that is all because of GABA has been messed with. The ethanol got in the way and didn't allow it to do its thing. But more importantly, ethanol can also affect how glutamate, which is another transmitter, functions. And so this one is the one that plays a key role in the way our brain forms memories or learns new things. So if you've ever had a drink or two or three, you might notice that towards the end of the night, your brain starts getting fuzzy, like your memories are fuzzy. You can't kind of tie things together. And that is what happens when your glutamate transmitter can't move. So when it can't move, we're unable to learn new things or make these memories. And so ethanol affects all of that. It gets in the way, and it essentially blocks the bonding that needs to happen.
Kate Bieberdorf, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Kate Bieberdorf is an associate professor of chemistry at the University of Texas at Austin. She's also a popular science communicator known as Kate the Chemist in personal appearances and numerous books for children. Her latest book is for adults, and it's titled It's Elemental, The Hidden Chemistry in Everything. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.